All right, welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is busy with sun things. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Okay, so today we wanted to talk to you about some general stuff about patient care. I'm entitling this piece, Stop Being a Patient and Start Being a Client and a Detective. So you want to feel like when you are going to a practitioner that you are the one who's in charge. I mean, the practitioner is somebody who has expertise, and they do probably have a lot more general knowledge about health and healing than you do. But they don't know anything about you. You are the expert on yourself. You know what you need. You know what you like. You know how you want to be treated. And you know what your goals are as far as your health. And so when you are talking with your practitioner, you want to make sure that you are coming from an empowered place. Of course, you want to be respectful. And you're not going to be ordering your practitioner around. But what you want to be looking for is a practitioner that's willing to be your partner in your care and is willing to be your advocate and is respectful when they speak to you. And if you don't know something, that they very calmly and rationally are able to explain it to you. And you shouldn't be afraid to ask your practitioner questions. If you have concerns and questions about anything, you should be able to ask them, and the practitioner should be willing to answer your questions to the best of their knowledge. The other thing a practitioner should not be afraid to do is to say, I don't know. And I do that all the time. If I don't know something, I'm saying, I'll either say, I'll look it up, or I know someone who would know that. And one of the things that you do as a good practitioner is you act as a traffic director. You help your patient and point them in a direction so that they can get the care that they need. Now, if that means you're pointing them towards the store so that they can buy kale, you do that. If it means that they need a massage and you're not a massage therapist, then you get them to a massage therapist. And you can take it one step further. And I mean, in my situation, I have massage therapists in my practice. But if a patient doesn't live in my town, I don't necessarily want them to have massage with my practitioners, because massage and physical medicine are things that you really want to do as close to home as possible, so that after you're done with the care, you can go home and rest. I used to go to a chiropractor who's a lovely chiropractor, but he was too far from me, and I was going to see him a couple of towns away, and it was a stressful drive. So I was in pain. I was stressed on the way there. I got the treatment, and then I'd come home, and I had a stressful drive on the way home. It didn't work out, so I went back to seeing my more local chiropractor, and the drive is not stressful. It's, you know, it's not in the same town as me, but it's one town over, and much nicer in terms of the drive. So you want to make sure that you're directing your patients to access services and products and things that they need, and that you're pointing them in those directions, and that you're not simply having them come in, talking to them for 5 minutes and giving them a pat solution and sending them on their ways. So I have a neat enumeration of some things that you do in terms of good patient care. One of the things I already expressed is that you want to be there for, that you want to respect the patient's values, preferences, and expressed needs, that you want to be listening to them and figuring out exactly what they're looking for, and don't impose your beliefs and wishes and desires onto the patient. If I would like to offer the patient something that they don't know about and that may be new to them, I suggest it, and I say it in a way that, hey, I wanted to tell you about this thing, and tell me if this is something you'd be interested in. So you just give them agency. It's not about me telling them what to do. Now, if somebody is in a life and death situation, and I think they're doing something to harm themselves, I'll tell them that. And again, I still have to tell them that in a kind and respectful way. You also want to coordinate care. You want to be able to access other practitioners. Now, I'm a naturopathic physician, and so for me, integrating with other practitioners can be edgy sometimes. I'm very proud of the fact that I have good relationships with many other physicians in this community, and to the point where MDs and osteopaths do refer patients to me. And that's not because I'm a nice person, and you know, I give good patient care and have a nice bedside manner and all that. But it's more because I very consistently reach out to these people. When I write a letter to another practitioner, I write I sort of have a format that I use, but it's always very respectful. It's very detailed. I communicate exactly what I'm looking for from the practitioner in a very respectful way, and I always end the letter with thank you in advance for collaborating in the care of this very nice patient. So that the very nice patient thing, that's something that you say, that when you there's a sort of a respectful scientific format when you're exchanging patients and when you're sharing patients with another practitioner, you actually speak not only to the fact that the other doctor respected you enough to receive the patient, to be sent the patient, but also that you gave them an opportunity to learn and for an intellectual advancement. So thank you very much for referring this very nice and interesting patient. So interesting means that there's an intellectual piece to it. It's very interesting, the words that you use. So you're also benefiting each other by sharing patients with each other, because good physicians see patient referrals as a learning experience. And so if we see you as a learning experience, we're going to be more invested in your care. And so, you know, don't feel that you're being used for learning in that way, because when we learn from you, we learn how to treat you better. We also learn how to treat other patients better. So this is not meant to objectify you. This is to learn how to be better practitioners. And also, you know, if you have an interesting case, say you have an interesting condition. Let's pull one out of the air. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is a very interesting condition where you have hypermobile ligaments that there's a genetic propensity to not making enough collagen, and so ligaments can be hypermobile, and people with Ehlers-Danlos can pull ligaments, they get sprained strains very easily, their ligaments don't hold their muscles together as easily, so they are more likely to experience musculoskeletal discomfort. And so if you come in and you teach me that, hey, I do have Ehlers-Danlos, but I figured out that when I do these kind of core exercises, I can keep my back pain in check, and you tell me exactly what those core exercises are, I'm going to get all excited, and I'm probably going to tell my other patients with Ehlers-Danlos with back pain, hey, you want to try these? It worked for this other person. And I might even tell my patients who don't have Ehlers-Danlos, hey, you have back pain? Try these exercises. So learning from you is awesome. It's really helpful. And it's another way of sharing information. And if you figure something out that works for your health and you offer it to me and then I offer it to the community, you should be proud of yourself. You did a good thing because you taught me and you helped you yourself, not even being a doctor, helped other people. That's great. So when we pay attention to you and what's going on, that's really helpful. So and you want us, you want to have a practitioner who has good coordination, that they, when they talk with other practitioners, there's mutual respect among those practitioners and they're willing to reach out to other practitioners. So I systematically do that. I reach out to practitioners all the time for records. I reach out to them for consultation. I refer patients. If you have a very specific thyroid condition, I'm going to refer you to an endocrinologist. I do that all the time, using those really great, detailed, respectful letters. So that's how you get respect in the community. You do it with diligence and consistency and respect, right? That's what you do. And that's what you're looking for in a practitioner. Also, You want your practitioner to inform you. You want your practitioner to educate you as best as possible. Doctor is teacher, anybody. That's one of the principles of naturopathic medicine. So anything that you want to know, I want to tell you. If you don't tell me differently, I'm going to give you I'm going to give you copies of your lab results. I CC you automatically. In order to not get CC'd by me, you need to ask me not to do it. And I do have patients, you know, they'll come in with records from another practitioner and I'll say to them, hey, is this your only copy of this? They'll say yes, no. If they say yes, I'll say to them, okay, I'll take a photocopy of it and I'll give it back to you. Some patients say, okay. Others say, I don't really need it. You can just keep it in the chart. And I say, okay. So I just keep it in the chart for them. But I always offer to photocopy it and give it back to them because I think you should have a copy of your records. I keep copies of my own medical records. I'm fortunate that I have an office and a practice, so I just have my own medical chart that's part of my, it's the same format as every other patient, and it's just kept in my office. So you want to give patients education, information about anything they want to know about. Like if they have a condition, you want to make sure they understand to the best of their ability what's going on. Sometimes I'm sort of surprised, but I really shouldn't be, by what people know and don't know about their bodies. When was the last time you reviewed, for example, how the reproductive system works? I mean, really reviewed it. I mean, you know where babies come from and all, but do you know, can you tell me from A to Z where babies come from, you know, from having the intercourse, how the sperm and the egg come together, how implantation happens. That's a whole process that people aren't really aware of, and how the menstrual cycle actually works. Those are things that that people don't necessarily know about. And so I have to explain it to them. I have a bazillion people come in, and bazillion is a technical term, who come in and tell me that they're hypothyroid. And, you know, we check them out and we treat them for their hypothyroidism. Hypothyroidism is alarmingly common. But then when you ask people, do you really understand how your thyroid works? They really don't. So you have to explain it to them. So you have to have a doc that is willing to take the time and explain that to you. And by the way, that stuff is really, I mean, it's really interesting to me because I'm a physician and I know about this stuff and this is what I'm expert at, but it's really good for you to know how your body works because it's better for you. You just know because, hey, I have a thyroid and this is what it does. And it's also good for you so you can be your own advocate. It empowers you and it helps you to advocate for yourself. So if you're going online and Googling stuff, and yes, there's jokes about, you come in and you're like, I Googled this, and, you know, some patients come in and they look at me sheepishly, I Googled this, and I'll try to say to them, okay, what did you learn? And let me help you unpack that or demystify it. And if you watch doctor shows on TV, you will see doctors mentioning that patients Googled this or that condition, and you'll see the doctor's eye rolling because sometimes it can be frustrating if you do that. But on the other hand, it's wonderful because you actually care about what's going on with your condition. Am I guilty of Googling stuff when I have a condition? Absolutely. I mean, I know how to unpack it a little bit better. But, you know, if you get some information, then you might want to go see your physician to help you figure out what's going on with it. So in a part of patient-centered care is their physical comfort. You want to make sure that they're physically comfortable in their homes, in their environments, that their pain is taken care of, their surroundings and environment. You want your office to be nice. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, super expensive and ritzy, but it has to be comfortable. One of the things that's nice is I practice in a 300-year-old farmhouse, and it's a beautiful 300-year-old farmhouse. I really feel like I'm a little country New England doctor. It's right on, it's right on a main drag in Mansfield. And when you come in, you feel like you're in a homey place. And it was, in fact, somebody's home at one point. And our wonderful landlord did wonderful renovation to the inside. And he tried to use sort of old-timey fixtures. He left the posts and beams in place. It's painted a very cheery color that brings the light in, which I really love. And my office, my actual physical office where I see you, is part of, I believe it's part of the old living room, that it was divided, and the other side, that's another office, was part of a huge grand room. And so my office space is very large, that you come in and it's very roomy. And I've had parents claim to me, my kids don't behave themselves. They feel too comfortable here. It's like they're at home or something. I'm like, okay, I know you're complaining, but I think I'll take that as a compliment. if you go to your doctor's office and there's homey things in there to make the people feel comfortable, they're going to want to come back. The other side of that is sometimes they don't want to leave. And we don't want you to leave either. It's just that when we have other patients, we have to move you along sometimes. And I try to be as respectful as I can with that process. You really, this gets back to bedside manner. You want to help the patient with emotional support and reassure them and help them with their fears. You have to really be able to support people with whatever's going on, whatever they throw at you. You have to be there for them, and they get all kinds of emotional. They can get angry, they can get mad, they can get sad, they can laugh uproariously, they can laugh inappropriately, they can do all kinds of things, and you have to be there to receive that and hold the space for them. And there's a saying we talk about, being compassionate but also dispassionate. In other words, you don't want to get in the bath with the patient because you want to be there as a support. But sometimes, you know what? You get close to your patients and you cry. It happens. You know, if a patient comes to you and the father just died and there's somebody you've known for years, you might cry with them a little. You know what? Patients like that. They like to see you as human. The other side of that is, like, if something happens to you and you tell them about it, sometimes the patients like the opportunity to give you some love. And when my father died, my patients were all over me. It was very sweet. You know, it was very kind. I shared with some, patients who I'd known for a long time, and they were very good to me. So it helps to make you human. But your patients are going to come in very anxious, and that's, anxiety is really, it's really easy to get in the bath with that. And it's a really great skill to learn how to step out of the bath and let the patient be anxious and you be calm and be direct with them and help to explain to them and help to alleviate their fears. Sometimes they have really, well-founded fears. If they're facing a bad cancer diagnosis, for example, you have to just be there for them. And you just have to be, yes, I understand. That's all you can do, because if it were you, you'd be terribly afraid and anxious as well. And you just have to say, I'm here for you and I support you. But that's a skill that not all physicians have. But if you have it, it will make you a much better and more popular practitioner. And it's the right thing to do, because people are coming to you and they're unburdening themselves with private things, things that sometimes they feel embarrassed about, and things that they sure don't understand. So you need to be there for them. It's really great. I really love it when families come in. So, if I have a couple come in, one person is the patient, the other person is there for support. That's great, because you know how they say, two heads roll better than one. So especially if the patient has a very complicated case, if you've got two people there, you've got two pairs of ears listening and two people to remember what's being said. And if one of the patients, if the patient is very upset, you might have a calmer family member there who can get some things down. Certainly if you have somebody who has cognitive issues, if you have a child there, or if you have, a spouse there, or somebody else who's a caregiver, they can get most of the information. And so you want to include the family in decision making. And, so when in my office, I have three actual chairs, which I set up if lots of family comes. And people are welcome to spread out. I have three chairs. I have a stool, which I'm supposed to be able to use. I use for examination, but, people can sit on it. And kids like to sit on it and spin on it, which is kind of fun. And I have a massage table, and I have, the examination table. And if the kids are in the office and they have to sit and listen to mom talking about their case for a long time, I'm like, just make yourself at home. You can go on the massage table. You can go on the other table. Just everybody should be comfortable when they come in. And if people are in the room, you include them in what's going on. You have to figure out. So like if you have a father and daughter come in, you have to figure out if the father is there just because they have to bring them there, or is the father there because they're adjunctive support. And so if you discern that they are in fact adjunctive support, then you include them in the conversation. And so you have to have good communication skills. Good communication skills are probably the number one thing that you need to have as a practitioner, beyond diagnosis skills, beyond caregiving skills, beyond physical examination skills. You got to be a good communicator. So continuity, you want to invite your patients back in a way that that's consistent and useful to them. You want to coordinate plans for the future. I always send my patients out with a recommendation sheet and plans for next steps. They're always invited back for another consultation. And if they do not reschedule, that is their choice. But there's always, when I send them out, there's some instructions to my staff to reschedule them and when. And most patients do follow that. And if they have to cancel, they cancel. But and also you want to, of course, provide information about other places that they need to be going. You want to make sure patients know where they can go to get certain kinds of care. And so when you're, so if they have issues with getting someplace, you want to give them ideas of, okay, this is how you can get there. You just want to make it easy for them to schedule appointments with you. So in my office, we don't have a system where the patient can schedule an appointment online, that the patient has to actually call and have a conversation with a real person. And that's how we still do our scheduling. We're a little old school that way. Although we do have a website where people can access us. And we do have enough appointments available. And if we had a situation where we were booked out for many weeks, we'd probably open up some space that we would leave for acutes. So, you know, if you, it can be very frustrating to call your PCP and you're sick today and you want to come in and they have no space for you and you wind up having to go to the walk-in. And often if you go to the walk-in, you have if you have copays, you have a larger copay when really you would like to see your PCP. So it's nice when appointments are available. You know, you want your practitioner also to refer you to people that you want them to have a referral network. And that's a really useful thing. And also to provide clear instructions on how to get referrals and clear instructions on how to do anything. And that is why all of my patients walk out with a piece of paper that discusses what we talked about that day. Sometimes if I'm not about to write something, I appear to not be about to write something down, my patients say to me, write that down. I'm like, okay. So I have a computer and, you know, patients are not always thrilled with us being at the computer, but it's kind of a necessary evil, if you will, because if I can type what's going on with you, I'm not going to forget it. And I'm going to be asking you about that stuff the next time that I see you. But I ask people for information, some demographic and personal information, just so I know what's going on in their lives. That's part of my view of patient-centered care. So you might wonder, why am I asking what your husband's name is, what your kids' names are, who you live with, what kind of place you live in, whether you have pets. It's because I want to know who's around you, what your resources are, what your daily life is like. And that all of that affects your health, and it affects the directions I'm going to give you to improve your health. And if your practitioner is not bothering to find that stuff out, they're not going to be able to help you as well. So that's it. So that's about being having good patient-centered care. And then in terms of being a detective, that's one of the other things that I mentioned, that you want to be your own advocate, and you don't want to put all of the onus on figuring stuff out on your practitioner. Your practitioner is there to give you information and give you ideas about what is going to help you. But you have to then go and implement it. And it's your job to actually implement it and figure out what's going on. And if something doesn't work, it's not necessarily because there's something wrong with the practitioner. It's because, well, it didn't work. And sometimes, there's only so much we can do about biochemical individuality, but biochemical individuality is totally a thing. And we're not necessarily going to be able to hit it right in the beginning. Also, if we give you something to do, I had a patient come in not too long ago who said he changed up his protocol on his own because he read about some other protocol and he went and he did it. But because he was having trouble with the thing I had offered him. And I hadn't seen him in a couple of months. I said to him, why didn't you tell me? So as soon as something is not working for you, get hold of your practitioner. If I had known, I would have changed things up for him myself a lot sooner than, you know, his office visit 3 months later. So don't be afraid to contact your practitioner and ask for guidance in the interim, because if they give you something to do, boy, if I give you something to do and it's just not working for you, I want to change stuff for you. So anyway, so good patient-centered care, and also taking responsibility for your health for yourself is a really good idea. And monitoring and tracking what's actually going on with you is really important. All right, so that was our first topic for the day. The next topic I want to talk about is early tips on managing the fading light. You know, it's getting to be that time of year again. Usually when it gets to be October, November, I start talking about this. But I am noticing, you know, where it used to be light outside at 6 o'clock in the morning, it is no longer. And I'm noticing that the sun is setting earlier. We are, of course, past the equinox. It is October. So we're starting to get into that steep slope where we're losing light at a rapid rate. And I always like to remind you, yeah, we're losing light at the rate of a couple minutes at either end per day. And that can be hard and it can be kind of depressing, but it's not going to last forever. And one of the things that happens is it sort of levels out when you approach to the end of November. You don't lose it as fast a rate, and it actually bottoms out in the beginning of December, and you start gaining minutes. You start gaining minutes at the end of the day in early December, like in the second week in December, you actually start gaining minutes, but you still continue to lose minutes at the beginning of the day. And that's why the days keep getting shorter up until the solstice. But you actually have a leveling out you don't lose minutes so rapidly when you get to around Thanksgiving, at which point you have a break usually. And then you have that bottoming it out at the beginning of December of the loss of light at the end of the day. And you actually start gaining minutes at the end of the day in second week in December. So it's not so terrible. However, it's happening. It's getting colder. We've got a situation where it's hard to know how to dress because the weather is going up and down. We are having some crazy weather. Yesterday was pretty crazy. There were some probable microbursts. We actually had either a very strong straight line wind or a microburst or a tornado in front of our office because we had a tree uprooted, and we had the power got taken out at about a little after 6 o'clock last night. And it was then, thank you to Eversource, it was back up in, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours. So that's great. But boy, there's this poor tree, bought it. It was ripped right out of the ground. You know, it's really crazy. So we have dramatic weather like that because we have weather that's just confused. Right now, you know, you have more dramatic weather in the spring and the fall because you have changing air currents. You have cool and warm currents fighting with each other, and things haven't really settled out. And you have, one of the things you also have is the water temperature. The water temperature is still warm. The water is starting to get cooler now, so peak hurricane season is done. But you do still have relatively warm water, and you have shifting air currents, so you're getting some dramatic weather and microbursts and crazy stuff going on. So that can be hard to manage, and you know, you have sudden power outages like we had last night. It was pretty freaky. But in terms of working on that light, it's a good time to make sure to look around and see, are there days that you can take some time and just relax? You know, this is time to break out the warm cups of tea and hot cocoa and just sit and relax and enjoy the fall. It's a great time to get outside. One of the ways to really combat losing the light is to really be outside, is to spend time outdoors. Even if it's just for a little while, even if it's for a short walk, if you have to work very hard and have a lot of hours, if you can just get outside for 10 minutes, it can really help. When you get outside, especially if the wind is blowing, you're going to get your negative ions. You're going to get negative ions happen because molecules bang against each other and they lose electrons. And so when they lose electrons, you get negatively charged particles. Those negatively charged particles, they come and they offer electrons to you. So it helps to it helps you with oxidative stress. It's really quite something. So wind helps you with that. Anywhere where there are molecules banging against each other. So when there's wind, when you're at high altitude and the molecules are separated by each other, so they move around a lot because of Brownian motion, so they'll bang into each other more. When you're at a moving body of water, especially white water, you've got water banging against rocks, so they're going to release negative ions. If you're at the ocean, of course, the neat thing about the ocean is you have many kinds of negative ions because the water is full of minerals. So you've got the air being agitated in concert with the tides, and then you have the actual tides crashing, and that's going to create more negative ions. That's why some people feel really great at the ocean, that they feel healed when they go to the ocean, just because you got a lot of mineral activity there. And going in the woods is great because in the woods you have trees, and trees, of course, are exuding oxygen for you, which is really great. And then you have plants on the ground. Right now you have plants that are dying back. And so the downside of that is there's going to be more mold around, which can cause immune and allergy symptoms. But the upside of that is that when you have bacterial metabolism, you get more negative ions. So, playing in the leaves is not necessarily a bad thing as long as you don't get too bothered by the mold. And if you're bothered by the mold, you should be cleaning out your nose. Use your neti pot. I also wanted to throw out there, the minute it turned into September, people started coming in with colds. I had two or three people come in out of my, roster of patients yesterday who had active colds. When I was at the bike ride on Sunday, I saw people who had active colds. So if you don't want to catch cold, it's time to wash your hands very regularly. Now the recommendation is 25 seconds. Doesn't matter if it's hand sanitizer or soap and water, you pick, but scrub hard all the way up to your wrists, all of your fingers, 25 seconds. And what's with the scrubbing? The scrubbing is you're rubbing the bacteria, viruses, fungus off your hands and you're disrupting their coverings. So it's important to scrub and do it regularly. And I've gotten slightly more neurotic about, hand washing. And I want to remind people that one of the places to make sure that you sanitize is if you're traveling right after you hit TSA. When you go through TSA, everybody touches those bins. So when you're on the other side of TSA, if there's Purell in the lobby of the airport, get some Purell. If there's not, it's a good idea to carry a little, a pocket-sized bottle with you. And, if you carry less than a 3 ounce or less bottle, you can carry it. They'll let it go. You can carry it with you and you pop it out when you're done and just hand sanitize. I've just started putting hand sanitizer in all of my bags. If you sanitize regularly, you're going to be less likely to get sick. There have been studies on physicians. Doctors who use hand sanitizer are cleaner and get sick less frequently. The other thing is it's a good idea to start being regular about cleaning your nose and your throat. And so if you want to use a neti pot, using a neti pot is great. If you don't feel like using a neti pot, you can do regular nasal sprays. And I do use antimicrobial nasal spray most days now. I have one with xylitol and saline in it that I really like. I also have one with grapefruit seed extract that I really like, grapefruit seed and saline. What happens when you do your nasal spray? The next thing that happens is you get a drip in your throat. What should you be doing about the drip in your throat? You should be gargling. You should be gargling anyway. Why? Because viruses attach to the back of your throat. So if you gargle, you're going to be less likely to get sick. So having gargling as part of your daily care routine is going to help you to get sick less frequently. So if you use your nasal spray and then you gargle, and you can gargle with salt water and you can gargle with xylitol, you can gargle with a mixture of both. Just sea salt will work. Probably just table salt will work. because salt disrupts the cell membranes and the protein coats of viruses and bacteria. So salt will kill most things if you have in hypersaline solution. Remember, what lives in the Dead Sea? Nothing. It's the Dead Sea. That's why it's called the Dead Sea. All right. So managing the fading. If you feel more tired this time of year, get more rest if you can. If you can find times to rest, if you can find times on the weekend to maybe say no to a commitment, because soon it's going to be the holidays. They're just around the corner. I'm sure you've gone to some stores already. And of course they're selling Halloween candy, but it is after all October. But there are some places that are having Halloween sales already. So get your rest when you can, when you can get it, because soon it will be Hanukkah and other holidays, and it'll be more running around. And if you've gotten into an exercise routine this summer, try not to let go of it. Some people, I find that their exercise routine goes by the wayside in the summer and they get back to a routine in the fall. Because I'm an outdoor exerciser, the change in the weather can be somewhat disruptive because, I'm used to getting on my bike and being able to be outside, and with more dramatic weather, with more rain, certainly with more cold, it changes whether I want to be outside or not. But that's when you have an alternative, that you have some way to exercise indoors. And I think that's always a good thing to do, to make sure that you have a place to exercise indoors, whether it's at a class or a gym or in your house. I always think it's important to have a way to exercise inside of your house. And there's ways to do that with a piece of apparatus. You can get exercise. There's just free stuff you can find on YouTube that are exercise routines. You can certainly get on-demand things. And you can also pay for services online where you pay a monthly fee that's often less than what you pay at a gym. And you get all kinds of classes at a particular website. And there are some that are dedicated to yoga. There are some that are many different kinds of classes, including yoga, Pilates, aerobics, fitness classes, weight classes, where you can pay for one service and they'll give you a bunch of different things and you can take the classes anytime. There's services where you get a particular kind of indoor bicycle that are hooked up where you can take a live class somewhere that's happening somewhere else. And, you're hooked into the internet, so you're taking a live class with somebody. And you can take those classes live, and you can take them at another time because they're recorded. Then you have that crazy system, Zwift, which is a bicycling app where you are hooked into a computer, and it's a virtual. It's like a video game. So it's virtual, and you're riding in certain locations anywhere in the world, and it's like a video game. You have an avatar on the screen, and you're riding with actual other people that can be anywhere in the world. So cool. So cool, let me tell you. So there's really no end of stuff like that. There's really no reason to not be able to exercise indoors. I also want to remind you that you don't have to do a half an hour straight of exercise if that doesn't work for you. Get up from your desk and do 5 minutes of squats. Get up from your desk and do 5 minutes of bands. Get up from your desk and do 2 minutes of stretches. Doesn't have to be done all at once. When it adds up over the day, it still counts. And you can track it. You can put it on your MyFitnessPal or your Lose It or your other cool app that you're using to track. And then you can look what I did. I'm so proud of myself. So that's important to do. So manage that fading light. It's okay. Enjoy the fall, enjoy the fall colors, get out and look at and be outside. Make sure to continue to exercise. Try not to overeat. Try to continue to eat your produce. There's still lots of harvest left. The harvest is changing. Now we're into our pears and apples and stuff. The apples are wonderful now, and there's all kinds of neat recipes you can use. The squash is coming out, so you've got your winter and your summer, not so much summer squash, but more winter squash now, and that's awesome and wonderful now, and sweet potatoes and all that. Great things to eat. It shouldn't be so hard to manage the fading light. It's hard because if I had my choice, I'd be somewhere warm all the time, but I'm not. My life is here. So I think one of the best ways to deal with the weather is to be out in it, and also to have solutions for what you're going to do and change what you do. And, you know, I don't mind having a winter where I have to spend a little more time indoors and snuggled up and getting some rest, because that's how the seasons work. It's really okay. And I can be happy about that. And I can, you know, maybe read a little bit or do a little bit more quiet activities. And I also exercise indoors, and that helps. So not stopping your exercise and not stopping your communing with nature is really useful. All right. What else would you like to know? Would you like to know when it's a good idea to have a sport drink? I would. So there's a nutritionist that says there's times when you really should drink a sport drink. Hydration is really important. There's a practitioner who was talking about how they were running a 10K and they kept passing the aid stations and drinking plain water and avoiding the sugary beverages. And, you know, that's fine if you're not exercising for a very long time and you're just sweating a little bit, plain water is probably fine. So drinking sugary liquids and drinking, sport drinks just as something to drink all the time is not a great idea. But if you're doing an activity for longer than an hour, you probably want to start thinking about a sport drink. Sport drinks were formulated for athletes, and there's a reason why they're formulated, because if you're dehydrated, even if you haven't exercised for more than an hour, if you're actually dehydrated and you consume liquids with sugar and salt in them, they get in faster. There's an osmotic advantage to getting the water into your cells when sugar and salt are present. Also, people tend to want to drink something more if they can taste carbohydrate. Even if the carbohydrate is fake, if it just tastes like carbohydrate, you're going to be more likely to want to drink it. Some people have no problem just throwing water down. A lot of people do. And you can should all over that. But the truth is that not everybody can throw back water. And there's different reasons why. I get people saying to me, I don't like the taste of water. And I only don't like the taste of water if the water actually doesn't taste good. So the water is going to be city water, might have chlorine in it, and then I don't like the way it tastes. Or the water has something else in it that's making it taste funky. So if it's got mold in it, or if it's got, it's got an excess of minerals. You go to some places in the country and there's a lot of sulfur in the water table. If you go to Florida, that's true. I always forget that. And I step out into Tampa or Sarasota, and I inhale and it smells like sulfur. I'm like, oh yeah, there's sulfur in the water down here. Just the water table's that way. And the sulfur's actually not that bad for you. It's actually pretty good for you because it is detoxifying. And when you go to Carson Hot Springs in Washington State and you sit in the hot springs, when it's bathtub, they encourage you to drink the water because the sulfur is detoxifying. But doesn't taste so great. And if you want to have water as your water, when I go to my mother, she filters it. But meanwhile, some people don't drink water because they don't like the way that it tastes. And some people just don't drink it because they can't get it in. And I have a little bit of that problem. In Chinese medicine, we talk about dampness. When your tissues feel overloaded and there's not enough movement of the fluid from your tissues into where it's needed, into your bloodstream, you can have a sensation of feeling waterlogged. So you can be thirsty and not be able to drink. That's a classic symptom of dampness. And it's also a classic symptom for homeopathic pulsatilla. Anyway, so if you get that, you're probably going to be more likely to drink something if there's something in it. So if it tastes sweet, you might be more likely to drink it. And now there's lots of beverages that you can get that are flavored that have natural sweeteners in them that are low calorie. So you can get beverages that are sweetened with stevia and or erythritol, which is a sugar alcohol made from corn. And a lot of times if the corn is organic, it can be non-GMO. So those beverages make it so that someone like me might be a little bit more likely to drink. And if it's going to be drink that or not drink, I'd say drink the beverage that has the erythritol and the stevia in it. You can also buy flavors that you can put into your water to make you want to drink it. So you can get little packets of dehydrated lemon and lime and grapefruit and orange. You can get stevia sweetened packets of lemonade. That's something you can get. You can also put actual fruit into your water. That can make you want to drink it more. I also will tell people to just do a quarter cup of or one quarter of their favorite juice, three quarters water and a pinch of salt, and that's and call it a sport drink. You can do it that way too, and you might be more likely to drink it. But if you're sweating a lot to the point where you feel the sweat and the sweat is coming out of you and you're exercising for longer than an hour, it's okay to, I think it's okay to drink a sport drink. I find a lot of commercial sport drinks excessive, like they're too sugary. They're really formulated for people who are doing very hard exercise and sweating a lot. So if you're exercising moderately, but it's more than an hour and you're sweating enough to the point where if you didn't have an electrolyte drink, you'd get some cramps, then you might want to dilute that stuff a little bit. But drinking sport drinks when you're not active, that's not really good for you. In fact, because of the minerals in it, some people get kidney stones from it. So the rule of thumb is after an hour of activity. Now, mind you, if you're a heavy sweater and you're doing an activity where you're sweating a lot, then it doesn't matter how long the activity is. If you're exercising for half an hour and you sweat a lot, then I think it's fine to do the sport drink. And we're not just talking about people who are doing a designated athletic activity. We're talking about people, if you're a line person, you work on the electrical, you work on the power lines, you do outdoor activity, you're a logger, you're a landscaper, you're on your feet a lot, and you are likely to sweat and get dehydrated, you can do a sport drink. That will help you because it will help you to get the fluid in faster. If you feel dizzy, fatigued, and headachy, and you can even get a rapid heart rate, you might be lacking fluid and also electrolytes. One of my favorite things, my favorite easy things, if people like the way it tastes, if you're feeling, if someone comes and says, I'm feeling a little nauseous and dizzy and I don't exactly know why, the first thing I'll question them about is their fluid consumption. And if you're on a dehydrating medication, for example, hydrochlorothiazide, if you're on a drug that leaches water from your body, you're going to be more likely to get those dehydration symptoms. That you need to replace your fluid and your electrolytes, and you're going to be more likely to get dizzy. What I have people do is I have them try coconut water. I'm a big fan of coconut water. Not everybody likes the taste, but if you do like the taste, if you're feeling dehydrated and you drink coconut water and you like it, you're going to feel better pretty quick. A lot of times people do. I find for myself, if I'm feeling a little off and I haven't had anything to drink for a while, I drink coconut water and I feel energized because it really works to get you hydrated quickly. Nature made this stuff. You know, it's a really good proportion of water to carbohydrate to get it in. If you want to throw a little salt into it, you can do that. But plain coconut water is often very good because it's got some carbohydrate in it and it's got a lot of potassium in it. And so the potassium is calming and the potassium and the carbohydrate help to drag the water into your cells. If you're getting a sport drink, you want to watch out for artificial colorings, artificial flavorings. And there are brands that are all natural now that you can get at health food stores. You want to watch out for high fructose corn syrup, of course. And Gatorade no longer uses high fructose corn syrup, which is very cool. It used to. So that's great. And there are other brands that are all natural. You can get them sometimes at health food stores. You can also get them at sports stores. So your little bike shop, your local bike shop is going to have some sport drinks that you can get. And you can find them online as well. I've told you about coconut water and, and of course the carbs are going to give you energy for your exercise. The other thing is salt. So let's visit salt for a minute or two. People are like, oh, if I eat salt, I'm going to get high blood pressure. Well, the whole salt thing is kind of overblown. The reason that people have issues with salt is because a lot of people don't get enough exercise, that therefore they're not particularly sweating, and they're eating a lot of food that's been processed and has a lot of salt added to it. And so their ratio of salt to other minerals is too high. If you're not doing that, if you're eating a largely whole foods diet, and you're not eating a lot of processed food, you can salt your food to taste with good quality salt. And it's not going to hurt you because you're getting your potassium and magnesium and other minerals from your produce. And so salt, it's equivocal whether it really causes high blood pressure. I would say that it can probably cause high blood pressure in somebody who's sedentary, who's not sweating, and who's eating way too much salt relative to potassium, magnesium, and calcium-containing produce. So that's the issue. The issue is you shouldn't be eating so much processed food with poor quality salt in it. The issue is that salt's perfectly fine if it's on your lovely organic salad with all kinds of vegetables in it, vegetables and nuts and seeds, and you're not eating processed food throughout the day. And so you should know that when you sweat a liter, you lose a gram of salt, of sodium. So that has to come from somewhere. So if you are sweating a lot, sport drink. And I think that if you're sweating a lot, it doesn't matter how long you're working out for. The rule of thumb is over an hour, but that's for people who don't push themselves very hard. If you're pushing yourself hard and you're sweating a lot, sport drink away. That's my take. So go get them. All right. So we have 5 minutes left of Radio Naturopath here on this October 3rd, 2018. And let me see. So I just have a couple other things. You might want to know why avocados are good for you. So I thought I'd talk about avocados because I like them. Not everybody likes avocados. What are you going to do? But I really like them. Some people find them strange tasting. They are sort of strange because they're mushy and they taste like a vegetable and a fruit and a nut all at the same time. And they are, in fact, a fruit. But they're weird because they're fatty. So they're sort of somewhere between a fruit and a nut. But they're super nutritious for you. I happen to really like them. A good ripe avocado, I could sit and eat the whole thing. It's known as Persea Americana. It's got a lot of nutrition. It's got a ton of fiber in it. It has thylakoids in it, which help you lose weight. There have been studies that say that people who eat avocados regularly weigh less than people who don't. They can vary in shape and color. They can be little and weigh half a pound, and they can weigh 3 pounds. The most common that we eat is the Haas avocado, often called the alligator pear because it's got like alligator skin. And we discard the skin and the seed, and they have a lot of nutrients. They've got vitamin E. They've got vitamin B6, they've got B5, pantothenic acid, they've got some potassium and C and folate and K. It would be K1. So it's got a lot of nutrients in it in a very absorbable form. It has some minerals in it, has a little bit of magnesium, manganese, copper, iron, and zinc, and phosphorus, and a little bit of carotenoids and B1, B2, B3. It has 9 grams of carbs, but they're mostly from fiber. So there's only 2 net carbs. They don't have any cholesterol. They don't have sodium. They're high in monounsaturated fat, which is a great anti-inflammatory fat. And per unit volume, they actually have more potassium than bananas. So 100 gram serving has, 14% of your potassium RDA compared to 10%, which is in a banana. The monounsaturated fats are good for your heart. It has oleic acid in it, like olive oil. So it's anti-inflammatory, has tons of fiber. So the fiber is going to help you with regularity and help you with, helps you to make good probiotics. The soluble fiber helps to feed that friendly gut bacteria. And so they can help your cholesterol and lower your triglycerides, because of the fiber, it's going to help to sweep it out. And it's also because it's going to lower cholesterol because it's reducing inflammation. And so it's something that vegetarians can eat, obviously. It says here that people who eat avocados tend to be healthier, They have a more, people who eat avocados tend to eat more nutrients and tend to weigh less. So it's a correlation. It doesn't imply causation. Because avocados are a little bit weird, people who eat them might be a little more adventurous in what they eat. So because not everybody likes that combination of creamy and nutty and a little bit bitter, it's probably an acquired taste, which I am fortunate to have acquired. So if you like that, you're probably going to like a lot of other healthy things. It really is a correlation. However, some of it is causation because the fiber and the monounsaturated fats are going to help you have a lower weight and just be healthier in general. So it's interesting. So people who eat avocados, they tend to have more nutrients in their body overall. And because of the fat that's in them, it can help you to absorb fat-soluble vitamins from plant foods like your carotenoids, your D and vitamin K. They also happen to have, they have lutein zeaxanthin in them, so they're going to be helpful for your eyes, and they're shown to be cancer protective. And they can help to reduce the side effects of chemotherapy, and because they're anti-inflammatory, they can help with arthritis symptoms. They've been shown, as we said, to help you lose weight. And there's all kinds of ways to make them. You throw them in your salad. You can eat them straight. You can even make avocado chocolate truffles. There are cool recipes for that. And you can blend them into your smoothies. They're really great and versatile. So I love avocados. Okay, so I encourage you to go out and find a way to eat an avocado that works for you. All right, so I have to go now. So you've been listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch. I will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath. And you've been listening to this call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM. WHUS Storrs.